Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your co-host, Chris Seveny, along with our special guest today, Dave Vernich. Dave is a commercial lender with over 30 years of experience in the banking industry. In 2007, he partnered with other investors and began his real estate journey. Today, he owns more than 100 homes in Tennessee, so I'm guessing he's busy with that. Hopefully, he has a property manager, but we'll talk a little bit about that. But I want to welcome, warm welcome, Dave. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So Dave and I are part of a group, GoBundance, which is a kind of a membership group for individuals who are looking to continue to grow and build wealth. And definition of wealth can always vary between monetary or time or experience. And today we're going to talk an interesting topic about retirement planning and talk a little bit about that. But first, Dave, why don't you share with us what you got going on today?
Okay. So yeah, Chris, I'm still a W-2 employee to this day, but I'm not working your typical 40-hour work week. I have a unique situation that people are jealous of. I do have what I call the 4-hour work week as my W-2. And so I have a lot of extra time on my hands as a result, but it took me probably 35 years to get to that point. So it's not something you can just jump right into. It takes years and years and years to develop that where you have the contacts to be able to produce what you're employer wants you to produce in a given period of time. But to answer your question, what kind of led to that, when I turned 45, I was a commercial loan officer, still am to this day. And it was in my 40-year plan, and you had mentioned the 40-40-40, especially 40-year plan, 40 hours a week for 40% of your income. I'm going to steal that for the future. I will reference Chris as the quote, the original source. Mm-hmm. But essentially, I used a metaphor of a 40-year work / retirement plan that most people are on from age 25 to 65. And at 45, you're at your halfway point. So, you know, running into the team locker room after halftime, it's good to make your halftime adjustments, right? So you're looking at the first half stats, and mine were incredibly poor to the point where I said to myself, if I don't change dramatically, I am so far behind the eight ball, I'm going to live in a van down by the river, like Chris Farley did at Saturday Night Live, you know, government subsidized cheese. So my wife wasn't working at the time. I had four sons to put through college. So it was just looking like really bleak in the second half. And so I didn't change what I was doing on the retirement side because I was essentially putting all the money I could afford to sock away in that and get my employer match. What I did change was I looked at people that I knew in my banking business that were in my commercial loan portfolio that had successfully been able to retire at a younger age. And across the board, the one thing that they had in common is they were real estate investors. And so I said to myself, I need to learn how to do what they did, knowing full well I couldn't do 90% of what they did. I'm not a handy guy. So essentially, probably what kept me out of real estate longer than anything is that I suck with anything having to do with fixing, repairing. I didn't want to spend a lot of time doing things. I mean, essentially, I'm the poster boy for you don't want me working on anything that requires, you know, renovations or repairs. So that kept me out.
You can put your picture next to mine, and I have some stories I'll share with you about that as we go. So
So I just had to basically have someone teach me the whole process so that I could figure out what value I brought to the equation. And the one and the only thing that I could do and do easily was bring capital. And luckily, real estate investing is a capital intensive business. So if you could find enough capital and marry that with people that have the time and the skills, you've got yourself a successful passive income side gig where you can keep your day job and let them do all the work.
So a few things I want to peel back from that. One is the Matt Foley reference. Awesome. Chris Farley's character was Matt Foley in The Van Down by the River. Actually rewatched that like 2 weeks ago and just, it kills me. It's such a great skit. What I really liked about what you said though, was peeling everything back into the, like you mentioned, the 40 years. And if you break it into four quarters and really look at things like, okay, you're starting at 25, you go 35, 45, 55, 65, kind of look at things from that standpoint. You're right. I mean, I, a few years ago, turned 45 and I was kind of like looking at the halftime score and I'm like, man, I'm behind. And that's where I got more involved in my side gig, which is mortgage note investing. But I think people need to realize that it is a marathon sprint, you know, four quarter game, however you want to look at it. It's not a, you know, 40 yard dash. And I think that's what I think a lot of people look at today is they want to retire by 30 or they have these aspirations, which are great to have. But what you have to realize too is understand the risk that you may have to take in some of those instances. And as we talk real estate, one of the things I see a lot of is people over leveraging or getting into deals that they're really, the numbers they plug into their pro forma are the rosiest of roses. And if something does go wrong on some of those assets, you know, it can set you back 7 years. And it's one thing I think people kind of, you know, need to look at. Now, you mentioned it's funny about, you know, you're not able to repair anything. So I'm an engineer by degree. I worked in construction management and real estate development for 25 years. And if anything ever needs to be fixed in our house, my wife is the one who fixed it. And when I look at her, she laughs at me. She goes, you're not touching it. And I joke, I'm like, well, I'm a background in management, so I can manage you on how to do that properly. And then, of course, I'll be sleeping on the couch for the next few days. But so yeah, I'm not allowed to touch anything either in my house. So,
well, I've always joked my wife hasn't. I wish my wife would tell me, stand aside and I'll do it. But I told her, honey, you know, the best, my favorite tool in my tool belt is the checkbook.
So you got into real estate and kind of what you did. And you mentioned that you noticed like a lot of other people. How difficult was it to get into, again, you have the commercial lending background, but was it still challenging for you or what was the difficulty or what were some of the things that challenges that you had with getting involved?
They're really the same challenges everybody uses as excuses. Today, I kind of boil it down to two different, it's kind of this old joke that probably many people have heard. The question is, what is worse, ignorance or apathy? And the answer is, I don't know and I don't care. And I use that joke to say, you know, people are ignorant about how real estate actually works. They think they've got to do everything from A to Z. That's what I thought. And knowing that I couldn't repair anything, essentially was, that's as far as I had to go, right? I don't know how to repair anything, so how am I going to get into real estate? That was the wrong answer. The right answer is more like the who, not how. Who do I know that can do that so that I can do what I'm good at? And then the second part of that is apathy. Even if you know you don't know something, do you want to fix it? You want to do something about it? So a lot of people kind of look at it and say, well, I don't want to do real estate because I don't want to get the calls at 2 a.m. for the toilets, right? Yep. The busted toilets that are always at 2 a.m. Real estate investing for 15 years and have yet to get that call. Not because they haven't happened. It's because I do have people that handle them, not me. So if you knock down these walls one by one that keep you from doing it and see what the true benefit is to you, and this has just supercharged my retirement so that today I could retire 7 years, 10 years earlier than I would have otherwise at 100% or more in this case of my annual income that I'm getting on my W-2. So you got to look at the prize as well.
Yeah. So I do want to go back to one thing you mentioned earlier, because it sounds like you took the book, The 4-Hour Work Week, and really took that to heart or something, because you're only working 4 hours. How the hell you pull that off? I got to know this. I got to hear this.
Well, two things. One is it's the who, not how. So on my real estate side, I don't have to get involved into a deal until I actually have a deal that's ready to go. Yep. So that eliminates all the looking. And if you're not doing all the looking, that's a lot of time just finding the deal. So my deals come to me on inbox and I either say yay or nay within seconds, just looking at the numbers. So there's that. And then I have the people on my team that do all the fixing up. And then I've got the people doing the property management. So my real estate side typically only takes 15 minutes from what I have to be involved in. My W-2 day job, which may be your current question is how do you get away with that, is I get a budget given to me on fee income and loans I need to book for the year. And once I hit that number, and because I'm located in an offsite office, not in a branch, by myself, I mean, if I can do it all on January 2nd, then in theory, they don't need to see me the rest of the year.
Okay.
So really what it comes down to is, it's performance-based, but it's also 30 years of contacts where people are calling me and I'm not doing the hustle and the grind anymore.
It's interesting because I like to sometimes call myself the most active passive investor because, you know, similar to like you in the commercial lending space, you know, we're in the mortgage note space. So we buy mortgage notes on the secondary market. So we, again, when you get back to talk about toilets, termites, and tenants, we don't deal with them because we're the bank, we're the lender on the deal, but we're also extremely active because a lot of stuff we buy is distressed. So it requires a lot of management and not management of us dealing with the borrowers, but us working with our servicing company and our attorneys to kind of come to some type of arrangement and workout. So it's active, but it's also very passive in the sense of we don't need to know how to fix a toilet, because if you ask, you know, Wells Fargo, I'm sure they don't know how to fix a toilet either. Now, I do know how because of my background, but a lot of people who invest in our space, again, we're the bank. And I always like to joke too, similar to, you know, another one is if you drive to any major metropolitan city and you look at the tallest building, whose name is on top of it? Typically, it's Chase, City, or, you know, it's a bank. So, you know, is Rockefeller, I think, said, you know, you want to, you know, own nothing and control everything. But yeah, so there's different ways for people to get involved in real estate. And like you mentioned, you are, have people. And that's, I think, one of the things I view as the most important aspect of the business is putting a team around you that is top notch. Would you agree?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to do it without a team. And the team, looking at it from the football analogy, you know, you got your quarterback, you got your running backs, you got your offensive line, you know, if you're trying to score points, everybody's got to do their job. And one person is going to be a skilled ball handler. Another guy's going to be a giant slab of meat that's there to block another slab of meat from finding you. So essentially, everybody's got their skill set. And if they stay in their lane and do their job and do it better than you could do it, then you've got an unbeatable team.
And sometimes it might not even be as better than the way you can do it, because a lot of people, especially who are type A personalities like myself, it's also what's your best use of time and your, what is your time worth compared to some others? If it's a, you know, if you say to yourself, hey, I would think I'm worth $100 an hour, and it's a task that is something that is basically somebody, you could pay somebody $50 an hour for, and even if it took them an hour and a half where it would take you an hour, technically, it's still better to have them do that, whether they're the same or even if it, you know, sometimes might even be not as great as you would do it, but it's still satisfying, you know, well above average and stuff. You know, that's some of the things that was one of the challenges I had was letting go early on. Did you ever run into anything like that?
No, because I wasn't good at anything. I was trying to find the one thing I could do so I could join a team, because it wasn't hard to beat me in some of those areas. Yeah. So I really had to focus on where did I bring the value.
Well, you got to be good at something, because we'll talk a little bit more now about kind of, you noticed that your halftime that, hey, I need to get somewhere. Can you talk a little bit about, okay, you knew you wanted to get into real estate, dive a little bit deeper into the plan or what you put in place and what you found was easier than you thought it would be? And what are some of the things like, damn, I didn't think this would be so hard.
Yeah. So this was 2007 when I bought my first one, and I actually paid my mentor to teach me. I paid $6,000 to go through their class. And at the end, we were going to do a house together. And I was responsible for all the money, coming up with all the money for the house. So I kind of took the class and bit my tongue and did exactly what they told me to do through the whole thing, looking for the value that I brought, and realized that I wasn't even the things I thought I could do, like finding properties. And this was during a time when there were tons of foreclosures, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say 2007. You know,
it was like shooting fish in a barrel, right? Well, I still struggled even to find the house. I was having problems getting a house, and I thought this would be the easiest part. So really what it came down to is I figured out the easiest part was, for me anyway, getting my first property using 100% leverage, which I don't recommend, but I didn't have the cash to do it. But what mitigated the risk on doing it that way is we bought the house for 70. We put 15,000 in it. And when it was complete, it was worth 115, which totally paid back that credit line.
Yep.
And so my original plan when I was doing this, before I realized I couldn't do many of the things I needed to do, was to buy one house per year from age 45 to 65, and then put a 20-year loan on each house. Mm-hmm. And so my house at 45 would be paid off at 65. And every year afterwards, every single house would be paid off. And those would generate $1,000 a month cash flow, which would be $120,000 in retirement income in today's dollars. So I thought that would be a great program until I realized I couldn't do that. I just had to team up with a team and take a smaller percentage, not take 100%.
Yep.
Because when you take 100%, you get all the headaches as well. So I outsourced all the headaches to people that are capable of handling them and took a smaller piece, which meant I had to have more houses than 10. Mm-hmm. And so we worked out a deal where I actually got 25% for doing the money side, bringing in the investor and also the permanent financing. And so I'd have 40 houses, and you would think it would take a long time. But when you had the team approach, we were doing about a house a month. So 40 came about way quicker than 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the things while you're mentioning that pops in my head is a lot of people, and I don't know if it's just a male ego thing, but when sometimes you mention a partner or team with people, people are like, no, I want to do it on my own. But putting a team together, and it's got to be, you know, written properly and make sure everyone's on the same page of who's doing what. But if you can share resources and partner and team, the scalability can be significant, you know, because each person might have a different expertise or specialty. And again, it's not easy to put together, but if you can put it together, it can be very powerful. And you're a case in point.
Well, my case in point was I had to have a team for all the reasons I told you about before. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I kind of had a little brainstorm and thought, you know what? There's very few people that have all the attributes you need to be a successful real estate investor just by themselves. They're out there, and I'm jealous of them because I don't. But there are people that can do it from A to Z, and they don't need to partner. But for the rest of us mortals, and that's the majority of us, or the most of us knuckleheads like me who don't want to leave their job, you need to have a team. And that's the missing link for a lot of people. You don't have to do it all by yourself. You don't have to be the superstar.
Yeah, it took me many years, almost 5 years to figure it out because I was working W-2 and I was running my note business. And it got to a point I was doing everything, managing and so forth. And then kind of I wanted to scale to a next level. And it finally came to the conclusion of, okay, in order to do so, I need to bring on a team. And I started out bringing on one person who has worked out excellent and perfect fit at the time that ended up coming on full time. And then, you know, since July, we brought on 8 other people. So now we have a team of work with us in our fund. And I look back now and it allows me, you can read all the books in the world and a lot of them are all very similar on the business side. Hey, you want to focus on your business, not in your business. But it's very true that once you start putting people, you know, in the right positions, it allows you to come back and start doing some of those things and be a visionary for your company and allow the company to continue to grow and succeed and benefit everybody. And that's, I think, an important component to it.
Well, and doing it the way I do it, you can keep your day job too. So that's always nice.
I kept mine as long as I could, but it came to a point where it was, you know, it was time for me where probably could have still done some consulting for them, but it was more just needed that clean break and wanted to spend 100% of my focus and time on kind of my new journey and my new venture. That's what I did. But no, that's another great point for people, you know, real estate. You know, I see a lot of people ask questions like, oh, how do I get in real estate or what type of job should I have? Or should I, you know, just quit and just work real estate? Probably 95% of real estate investors have a W-2. It might even be higher. I don't know. I'm just throwing a dart at the wall there. But real estate's something that, depending again, what you want to do with it and take it, you know, it can go up and down, but it's easy to do with the W-2.
Well, from a banker standpoint, if I'm the banker and I'm trying to lend money, I'd rather somebody that has a W-2 income and a real estate income versus somebody that just said, hey, I quit my job and I'm just going to buy my first one because I probably can't help them.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I see people ask, like, because, you know, we're in the mortgage space and sometimes people ask, hey, do you do private lending and stuff? And we'll say, well, we may do a deal, but we really want to look at kind of the structure and stuff. And now first question I'll ask is, they're like, oh, I don't have W-2. I'm like, okay. I'm like, sorry, but we're not even going to look at that because if you know, the project doesn't go well, I tell people, like, we require personal guarantees and a lot of other things that we would need. And, you know, there's no W-2 or nothing behind it. And also they're like, oh, and do you provide 100% financing? I'm like, let me just rub the little genie jar here. And, you know, and again, you can get sometimes 100% financing, but, you know, you really kind of got to fish for it and maybe get a seller financing. But it's something that if you do find, you may end up costing more. But also, just like you mentioned, you don't recommend it. I don't recommend it, even if you can get it, just because of the risk profile. You know, if property value drops by 20% and you're 100% leveraged, your options are, you know, all of a sudden you have a tenant that leaves and damages a place, you're stuck. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, I've learned a lot in 30 plus years of banking, and one of which is do not pile more money on somebody than they can prove that they can repay, because ultimately you're inviting Murphy's Law to move in.
Yeah. Somebody mentioned to me, and I'm curious your thoughts, some on the commercial, they said their perfect borrower is the person who doesn't need the money. And what they mean by that is people will use the money because it's a strategic, like when rates are at 3%, they may have the money that they could pay cash, but it's like they will use it because they can put their money somewhere else for better than a 3% return that they're paying on the mortgage. The people who are desperate and need the money are your worst type of borrowers, is what I've heard. Is that true?
Yeah, I've always told my customers when they've had a good year that it's time to borrow some money. And they're like, well, I don't need the money. And I tell them, well, you don't understand. You can't get the money when you need it. You can only get it, but you don't.
Speaking of which, kind of want to switch topics because you are on the commercial lending side of things. I'd like to spend a few minutes just talking about that and what you're seeing in the markets and some of the impacts that might have on overall markets. Because people forget the commercial real estate market is pretty big market, you know, and there's been a lot going on with offices, work from home, downsizing, retail that's in multi-use buildings, you know, is taking a beating, you know, a lot of big box retail is, you know, vacating, and then strip mall owners basically have to repurpose some of those spaces of smaller tenants. What are some things you're seeing in the space?
Well, cap rates have actually gone down over the years when people, when people were chasing deals. And so interest rates have moved up while cap rates have moved down, which is a bad combination, because essentially what you have there is more and more of the profit or the cash flow is going to pay the note and less of it's going to use the owner. So essentially when those lines cross, I mean, it's game over. I mean, you don't have the cash flow generated from the property to service the debt. You also have a lot of commercial loans that have 10-year balloons on them. So things that were done 10 years ago are ballooning this year. Well, 10 years ago, your rate was a very comfortable rate. Now your rate is double or more than that, and your rents may have not doubled, and maybe you have a vacant property now. So there's going to be a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth in the next few years as these balloons come due.
Yeah, I thought I saw somewhere, I thought there was a number of over $1 trillion in loans coming due in the next like 18 months in commercial. I don't know if that's correct or not, but it was a very high number. And like you mentioned, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And a lot of these deals that may be syndicated that people invest in, and a syndication is kind of you invest in an individual asset that the sponsor may have raised money. I've heard, especially on the multifamily side, a lot of capital calls coming in because they need to refinance and they get what's called a debt service loan, a DSCR loan, and you have to meet certain requirements or minimums of the income's going to be a certain percentage of, you know, the debt, your mortgage payment, which might be a 1.25 so ratio, and those aren't being met. So the only way to meet that is to get a smaller loan, which causes potential capital calls. Are you seeing some of that as well on some multifamily stuff?
Yes, and banks have gotten much more strict on new acquisitions and not are leveraging the maximum LTV that people want. Yep. I mean, basically, people always forget this. They always put the collateral value ahead of the cash flow. It's really a loan against the cash flow secured by the collateral. So it's always cash flow first.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially on the commercial side and, you know, what they're looking for based on that. And, you know, I'm just curious, you mentioned banks are getting more conservative on loan to value, which I'm guessing means a higher DSCR, because I've saw some people doing loans at like 1 and 1.1 a few years ago. And I'm just like, man, oh man, that is risky play right there. And I'm just curious, what are you seeing around today's? I've seen it as high as 1.35 in the past. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, typically banks like 1.25 in good times, but even now today, because of the incomes are being squeezed a little bit and the debt service is increasing, which is taking more of the cash flow, mm-hmm. you know, essentially, even if we could do a 1.25, like you pointed out, that just means we're lending you less than we would have based on the appraisal. So you could say, yeah, we'll get a 1.25, but that's 50% of appraised value. I'm like, what? You were doing 80% of appraised value before. And I'm like, we're maintaining that 1.25. It's just based on the cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned something else too about cap rates and, you know, the cap rates. Somebody sent me a property the other day that they wanted to sell it at a 3.2 cap. And I kind of just chuckled and laughed. And, you know, commercial rates are different than, you know, residential rates. Do you want to two questions is where do you typically see your commercial rates or loans currently or approximately right now or range? And what is your kind of prognosis where you think cap rates are going to be headed over next 12 to 24 months?
Well, I think cap rates are going up, a major call right there. I think everyone sees that they have to come up because rates aren't going to come down like they were to zero on the Fed side. Mm-hmm. And as far as five-year rates, which is where we typically do on commercial, 6.75 to 7.25 is where I'm seeing it. Mm-hmm. Prime is at 7.5. The Fed's meeting February 1st. Probably going to bump another quarter, half a point. So you could be 7.75, 8% in February, but the long-term rates are based on the bond market. So, you know, 6.75 is kind of where we are today, but that can change depending on what the bond market, how they absorb that information.
Yeah. And typically, like you mentioned, cap rates going up. Again, historically, they're higher than the rates because if they're lower, then you get leverage. It's like you said, you're just killing your cash flow and it's hurting your returns or your cash on cash return where, you know, historically, they may, class A properties may play right around the same cap rate as interest rates, but typically they're slightly higher, correct?
Correct.
So people who were buying things or thinking that they could exit something at a 4 or 5% cap rate, I'm guessing are probably back to the drawing board right now and trying to figure out their next play would be my guess, correct?
Yeah, I would say their whole basis is on based on hopium.
I mean, that's important because I think a lot of investors, and again, especially some of these multifamily, and again, I've come from a multifamily background, and that's where you see the largest syndications, where it might have been a five-year hold because they were basically banking on, hey, we're going to get a five-year loan at this rate. We'll hold it for 5 years. We'll get it stabilized. We'll upgrade it and, you know, bump up rents and then basically look to sell it or refinance it at the end of 5 years, right before that loan is due. All of a sudden, now a lot of the commercial markets, from what I've seen, have slowed significantly. And that was kind of the next question I was going to ask you, but also it's slowed and there's no buyer or the refinance is you thought, again, you were going to be able to refinance at maybe a 4% rate. Now all of a sudden you're at 6.75. Your money's not getting out of that deal and you may have to put more money in it. So
if you've got it, and some people do and some people don't.
So overall, you kind of seem a little, you know, I don't want to use too bearish, but I think realistic is the term I'd like to use, where you think interest rates and the Fed rate is going to be over the course of the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. You're kind of, I'm sure, in tune with that type of market. What are you seeing or what are you predicting?
Well, I think we've seen the worst of the 3/4 point raises behind us, but I still think that we're going to edge up. So all the forecasts I'm looking at, and even Jamie Dimon with Chase Bank has said he sees Fed funds going up to 5. So that probably puts us around 8% on prime rate. That should kick cap out at that. That's on variable rate loans. So if you're at 8% prime and you're doing a development and it's prime plus one, you're now close to hard money rates, you know, at 9%. So it's going to really slow down new construction for sure. Have several builders that I've talked to that are just going to sit on the sideline because based on not being able to control what interest rates are doing, nor can they control what supplies are costing or when they can get the supplies? It's just easier for them to sit on the sidelines than to take the risk.
And have you seen, that was my other question I now recall, you know, have you seen a slowdown in the commercial transaction and new origination side of things?
Yes, especially with spec builders building things on spec and not having anybody have a contract on that house. Banks have essentially cut most of those in half of what they were willing to do prior to this. So that by itself, I mean, a lot of builders have to build just to eat, to keep their crews busy, make payroll. And so they're going to have to start winnowing down just like some of the tech companies.
Yeah. You know, long term, do you see this year the Fed starting to drive rates down a little bit this year? Or do you think we're in for a little longer time frame? I personally think it's going to be longer than people expect. I know some people think, you know, by summertime, the Fed's going to pivot and start dropping rates again. I don't see it, but I'm just curious to get your opinion.
Yeah, I kind of expect that might happen in an election year in 2024. Yeah. So yeah. 2023, I don't think it's going to be the year they're going to try to touch that, because that'd be that would be admitting that they had overshot it, which they probably have, but that would be them admitting it.
Yeah. So good point about, you know, again, the election year and me being right outside of Washington, D.C. It's interesting how certain things, how that plays out. So as we wrap up this episode, share some final thoughts. What has been your kind of just over 15 years, kind of one of your biggest lessons learned that you can share with people to give them some advice as they either get started or continue to grow their business?
Well, for people getting started, I mean, it's my biggest regret. And I think anybody that does investing like this that realizes the things that kept them from doing it really have kept you away from multiple years of growth where you could have been doing this so much earlier. It's just so many people's mindsets have got to knock over those blocks that are keeping you. And you got to sit down and really be honest with yourself and saying, what is keeping me from doing this? And is there an answer to get me over that hump? And there is an answer, because essentially everybody has the same issues that they're dealing with: lack of money, lack of time, lack of skills. But how do you overcome those? And so if you look at them logically and find the answer to knocking over that block, that'll get you started way earlier than if you just said, it's too easy to accept my own excuse that I've made up to keep me from doing this, and I'll keep on moving down the road and not getting any closer to your goal. So that'd be the first thing. The second thing is just having the power of leverage on other people's time and other people's money. Leveraging other people's time is probably the greatest gift that people don't realize they have the power to do by joining a team, like we had discussed earlier, but also leveraging your borrowing capacity as an individual. So many times people will borrow easily for their own house, which is not an asset. It's not putting money in your pocket on a on a monthly basis. And they stop right there. They'll borrow money for a house, they'll borrow money for a car, even vacations, credit cards, but they will not borrow money to buy an asset that will pay the loan through a renter renting the house, which boggles my mind, but it's true. You ask most people, do you have a house you rent out that pays a mortgage? And the answer is going to be, for the vast majority of people, no, I do not. And then you ask why, and you're going back to the first one. I've got this roadblock, haven't been able to overcome it.
Yeah. And I think part of the challenge is, me, you know, my opinion is, and people can disagree, I think financial education and financial management in this country is something that is not taught, that really should be focused in schools. I mean, I remember going to school, we didn't have any of these classes like accounting and finance. I remember when I graduated college, and I'd like to think I was smart, I graduated an engineer, and I went to go get my first car loan, and I'm like, oh, it was 6% in a $24,000 car. I'm going to pay over $30,000 over. I'm like, I'm not giving them $10,000 in interest in 5 years. And my parents are like, welcome to Earth, you know, and, you know, in my first house, I bought it 6%. And then you realize, yeah, the first 10 years is basically pretty much all interest on the property. And, you know, that's not taught, or just how to balance a budget. I mean, you may take like a week on it, but I learned more of how to write in cursive, or how to play the flutophone or whatever, a recorder. You spend, you know, a year playing a recorder in elementary school, but, you know, they never teach you how to manage your money or understand what inflation is. I know they've gotten better at it, but it's still very challenging. And we have a colleague who I know who, you know, just graduated college, and asking them about like 401ks, and you just ask, you know, like, they have no idea. Like, it just blows their mind. And, you know, again, same thing when I graduated in 97 from college, and I didn't realize, I think that's right when Roths came out. And I'm like, if I would have known Roths back were around back then, because I lived at home for a year while I worked, I would just stash so much money in a Roth and paid it after tax, not realizing it. So there's so much information out there for people, but I think also part of society would rather be on social media and just watching the train wreck or comedy versus trying to further educate themselves. So.
Yeah, it's hard to get people to be focused on something that's 40 years down the road. That's another thing, you know?
Yep, no, exactly. But I tell people, if you ask anybody who's at that point in their life, what's the one thing they wish they did better, which is either invested sooner or save sooner and plan for retirement. Because it goes back to what we talked about earlier, that, you know, 40-40-40 rule. And I know a lot of people, because my parents and all their friends who retired over the last 5 years and stuff, all basically, a lot of them still working or trying to figure it out, because unfortunately, working the W-2 and only putting money into a retirement account is not going to get you where you need to go.
No, not unless you're looking to live in a van down by the river, like Chris Farley.
Exactly. Oh, David, thank you for joining us today. If people wanted to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Two ways. One is, I do have a book on Amazon that was released in October. It's called Middle Class to Millionaire, Making the Leap to the Next Level. So that's available on Amazon and on Audible if you don't like to read. That would be one thing you can do. And then secondly, I'm a W-2 guy still, so I'm on LinkedIn. So just hook up with me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And as a bonus for your listeners, I'll be glad to send them a free copy of the book. It'll be an ebook, a PDF, but they just need to hook up with me on LinkedIn, tell me they heard about me on your podcast, and I'll send them a free PDF copy of the book.
Awesome. Thank you. And we'll have his contact information in the show notes so people can go in and connect with David through LinkedIn, or feel free to also acquire the book on Amazon or Audible or your favorite listening. So everybody, thank you for listening to this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. As always, please make sure to leave us a review and subscribe to hear the latest episodes. Thank you all. Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.